At this time, we begin the Cygnet. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. And along with Mel, K2KEY, we try to collect people's questions and try to give them answers. This hobby of ham radio is a little bit on the complicated side. And so, since there's 26 or so different kinds of ham radio, and 2-meter FM repeater type that you're listening to right now is just one of them, obviously people are going to have questions about favorite transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, methods of modulation, and so on. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. Into EO, Rich and Yes. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
Yes, KC2LTY, yes.
And Mr. LTY, what's your name, sir?
Rich, got me?
Sure do, Rich. Okay, we got Rich. Anyone else?
This is W2PNJ, Bob. No.
Okay. That's one of the rare times you said a no, Bob, but let's hope you do develop a question after you hear. We've got Rich and Bob. Anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve and Yes.
Okay, we got Steve and a double. Who was the other person?
KB2LQN, Walt, and Yes.
Okay, we got you, Walt, LQN. Okay, I got to spell your name right. Rich, Bob, Steve, and Walt. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name.
W2OS or no.
Okay, Bob said no. Anyone else? That was an extremely broken up signal. We heard W2 something. I'm going to move to a slightly different position and try again.
W2BIE, no. Good evening, Rick.
35, Mr. BIE. Thank you. Anyone else check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
And good evening. All this is K2KEY.
And that mysterious guy is Mel. The second vice president or the vice president, I'm not sure which, of the technical net. Paul, WS2N, are you on board tonight? Maybe we don't have Paul yet. So, one last call. We've got Mel, Rich, Bob, Steve, Walt, Bob, anyone, and Mr. BIE. Anyone else?
No questions.
Okay, I think that was Dave MAR. Okay, the first real question was Rich, KC2 Lima Tango Yankee. You got the floor, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I don't know if I talked to you about this a while back about a 10-meter antenna. I'm using a 10-meter, actually 11-meter, Amtron 99 for 10 meters. And I think I told you that a dipole is not going to work for me because of warehouse buildings that are in the way. And I'm using it right now, and it's working, except I think I could do better if I would have a higher altitude. And I have it right now at the base of the antenna, I would say 26 feet. Maybe 20 and 26 feet is the base of the antenna. Is there a better antenna for a vertical for I can use for 10 meters other than a 99? KC2LTY.
Okay. To my knowledge, Mineola is not that dense a community. There are even lots of individual homes there, Rich, where you live. Once again, run that by, what stops you from using a dipole on 10 meters? Dipole on 10 meters would be around 16 feet long, and that's strung in the trees or against the side of the building. The dipole can be horizontal. The dipole can be suspended vertical. So are you telling me you don't think you have 16 feet of clearance somewhere end-to-end to put up a dipole? The reason I'm saying that, Rich, is that, boy, it is difficult to beat the performance of a simple antenna as a dipole. If you paid $1 zillion for a 10-meter ground plane and mounted it at the exact same altitude as the dipole, you might not do better with the ground plane. Yeah, it's a little bit easier to make it vertically polarized, and it's a little bit difficult to make the dipole vertical, a little bit more easy to make the dipole horizontal, and the ground plane antenna, not so easy to make it horizontal. So you've got those differences, but a ordinary ground plane antenna is going to be in the vicinity of 10 feet long. The dipole is going to be around 16 feet long. So, and the dipole contains, you know, a couple of dollars worth of materials, some wires, some insulators, and a feed line. And if you want to be a purist, a balancing device, which maybe is a mechanical support. So, I know you said you've got some trees and you think you don't have enough property. Are you sure that if a really smart guy puts on his good mechanical engineering glasses and looks at your property, you wouldn't find a way of stringing, even if you have to zigzag it, a 16-foot dipole couldn't be strung on your property or around your house somewhere. So let me give you some, let me have you some more, here we go, give you a little more information on that one, Rich. KC2LTY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick. To the north of me, I have a warehouse, which is a steel roof building, which is approximately 30 feet to the peak. It runs east to west, about 200 feet. So I'm like, it's like a big shield to my north. To my west, I have the Long Island Railroad. And I have a school. To my east, it's not much. But I'm in a confined little box. If you saw my property from a satellite picture, you'd understand it much better. The length of the property is 100 feet by 25 feet wide. And the house is taking up half of, more than half of that area. So, just a string of wire 100 feet long is not going to be in the picture. So, what I have right now is I planted a tree a couple of years ago, actually a Canadian sugar maple, maple tree, which is now in the neighborhood of 30-something feet tall, which I have a line into that. It's a 6-meter dipole, which is going back to the house. It's not clearing that building in the back. And I have a vertical MTON-99 tuned for 10 meters, which works to a point, but I'd like to improve that reception. Now, putting a horizontal dipole in is not as for altitude height wise it's going to be the problem and the length. I'm just, you know, working towards putting in a vertical antenna. What would be the optimum antenna for that application? KC12.
Okay, Rich, you said one statement that I'm having trouble understanding. You said you can't string a wire 100 feet long. If 10 meters you're talking about, a dipole in 10 meters is 16 feet long, 16 feet long. So what were you saying, you can't string a wire 100 feet long? Maybe you're talking about the total length of feed line required to get to the antenna. So run that one by again, Rich. Go ahead.
All right, that's going towards the G5RV. Which I think is 100 feet long. No, but to me, to put a dipole antenna in, I'm in a little hole in the ground. You might put, if you look to my to the west, there's the Long Island Railroad and the building, and if you look to the north, I have a warehouse 30 feet high with a steel roof. You look to the east, there's houses next to me, and you look to the west, that's my house. So I'm in a little hole in the box. So to string a dipole is not easy to do. I have a 6 meter dipole right now from a tree that I have in the backyard, which is not very big, to the house. And it works, yes. I also made a 6 meter ground plane. And actually the ground plane worked better than the dipole, because I can get better height going straight up. That's my question. Am I better off, in my situation, I'm better off to put a vertical antenna up versus a horizontal?
Okay. Since you seem to be in the in kind of a well with those buildings around you, and the average height of your land is considerably lower than those buildings, down in that well in your backyard, whether you use a horizontally polarized antenna or a vertically polarized antenna, is not going to make a heck of a lot of difference. The fact that you've got these blockages around you is certainly hurting, and anything you can do to get above those blockages is certainly going to help. Now, depending on how gutsy you are, there are some guys who will either climb on top of that steel roof of that warehouse and string some kind of a monofilament line that's sort of invisible from that roof over to some other structure on the other side of your property and hang the dipole in the middle of it. Some gutsy guys will do that. And if you can't get access to the roof on the warehouse, well, then with a slingshot and a... And again, monofilament line with the right kind of a fly casting arrangement. You can use the slingshot and the weight to shoot a line over the warehouse, again into your backyard, and the second shot is over whatever is on the other side of you, and again with monofilament, nearly invisible wire, invisible fishing line. You can hang a dipole using these high buildings as a support structure. That's one approach, depending on how gutsy you are. And even if at worst somebody cuts it down because they discover it on their roof, the total investment is small and not a great loss takes place. Another approach would be to have some form of telescoping tower that jets out of your backyard. One of these kind of towers where three, four, or five sections telescope inside of each other, and they've got guy wires on them, or they could be guy ropes going to the corners of your property, and you push these things up where no matter what kind of an antenna you hang, whether it be an inverted V dipole from the top of the telescoping tower, or whether it be a ground plane antenna, any kind of an antenna that you hang up there has the extra altitude of the telescoping tower, and that helps you get above the building. You don't have to clear the building by a whole lot of altitude before you'll start getting signals beyond them. But to be a whole lot of feet lower than the building, yes, in those directions, you're going to get some serious blockages. Without a doubt, Rich, you've got a very challenging environment to put up an antenna. Do you believe one of these Telrex telescoping towers, is there enough place in your backyard where you could mount it and put guy ropes and guy wires to the corners of your property in order to properly support it? It may take some drawings on a piece of paper to figure it all out. If the angle between the guy rope or guy wire, if that angle of the support and the vertical portion of the tower is much less than 20 degrees of an angle, the tension on the guy wire starts going up pretty fast, and the amount of support you get is starting to become marginal. So as long as you've got corners of the property where you can bring the guy ropes, the guy wires over to, and if you can keep the angle to the tower of the wire beyond 18 or 20 degrees, you've got a pretty good support. And by way of the telescoping procedure, you can bring the thing down, you can change the antennas and push it back up again, and with it you'll get some altitude. And whether you put on top of that dipole or inverted V dipole, or rhombic, as I said, or square loop type thing, or ground plane antenna is your choice. So, do you think a telescoping tower is possible? Is question number one. And do you think if you get some gutsy guys over there with bows and arrows and slingshots, that they could string monofilament lines over the tops of the roofs of those of that warehouse nearby? KT2, LTY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I got a question for him, Dick, K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, I know quite a number of people that are doing quite well with a vertical on 10 meters, and he says he's not doing that well. My question to him is, that vertical, how many radios does he have on it over?
You got it, Rich.
You mean ground plane radios?
That's what he's talking about.
There's no ground plane radios on it right now. Someone gave me this antenna. It's just a Amtron 99.
What's his answer?
Yeah, without the ground plane radios. And by the way, how many feet is the bottom of the antenna above the ground, Rich?
Maybe 25 feet. So my 2-meter antenna is 36 feet on a steel pole, which is in a good location. Now, on the side of the house, I got the 99, which is about, from the base to the ground, I would say about 25 feet.
Now, are you saying that the Amtron 99 is a vertical antenna that requires no ground plane radios? I wonder, let me turn it over to Mel on this one. Is it a little bit like the Ringo Ranger, which also has no ground plane radios? Are you familiar with the Amtron 99? Mel, I'm not. You got it, Mel.
That's it. It was originally sold for CBs. Should I say more?
Okay. You take, for instance, the Cushcraft Ringo Ranger, Rich. It's an antenna with no ground plane radials. And over the years, lots of guys have signed into the TechNet. Some of them love that antenna. Works like a charm. Others think it's the worst thing ever was ever invented. It's terrible. And the difference is that some of these guys mount it on a piece of pipe that has just the right length, where, because there's no ground plane radials, the antenna is launching current into the support structure, the thing that you mount it to. And if that support structure is at the right altitude with the right length, it's the other half of the dipole, so to speak, and the thing works like a charm. And if it's the wrong length, you can have a null on the horizon and squirt a little bit of signal above the horizon, a little signal below the horizon, but all the repeaters you want to talk to with the Ringo Ranger on the horizon, with that particular mounting arrangement, work poorly. So there's lots of variations in what people think is the performance of that antenna. I'm beginning to think the Amtron 99 with no ground plane radios falls into that category. So I think the choices are you either add the ground plane radios, even at altitude, and it's a little bit of a pain in the neck, but yes, it can be done. Or, let's see if Mel has any other suggestions. I'll bet you there's ways of adding the ground plane radios to that Amtron. What do you think, Mel? H-U-K-E-Y. H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, definitely. I've known a number of people taking, you know, the CB antennas and, of course, adopted them for 10 meters, being it so close to the 10-meter band with a little cutting. They will work quite well on 10 meters, but you must add radios. That's such nonsense that they've been peddling for a long time that, you know, a vertical can be stuck up there and no radials required. And for CB, yes, because they're not... Yeah, actually, you know, if we want to look at the original concept of the CB band, it wasn't meant for working DX, Dick, over.
N2XDJ.
N2XDJ. And we're going to pick you up with a second. Rich, I'm going to give you a little bit of an understanding here of what's going on. You've heard the word ground plane radials. You may have heard the word counterpoise. And what does it really mean? I'm going to give you a physical example. And the guys have heard this one a whole lot of times. Make-believe Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle while it's in orbit. He's in free space. And assume that Arnold weighs 200 pounds. And in his hand is a 200-pound barbell. And he wants to shoot the barbell off to the north for some reason. So he pushes the barbell off to the north at 10 feet per second. By Newton's third law, action and reaction, Arnold will also be moving 10 feet per second to the south. The two of them were at rest. He was holding onto the barbell. He pushes it real hard, and it goes off to the north, 200 feet per second. By action and reaction, Arnold's body must move to the south, 200 feet per second. The net result is they're spreading apart 20 feet per second. Okay, when you've got an antenna that's launching current into the radiating section of the antenna, just like Arnold with his muscles pushing, it is pushing current into the radiating section of your antenna, your vertical in your case. It's got to push against something. The something is the ground plane radials. If the ground plane radials are not there, the antenna ends up pushing against the structure that you mount it to or the coax cable that's going to it. And you start launching currents on the outside of the cable. Depending on the lay of that cable, the length of the cable, or the length of the support structure that you're launching current into, is an equal amount of current is going into the real vertical portion of the ground plane antenna, and an equal amount of current is going into something that's the counterpoise, whether it's there or not, feed line, support structure, and so on. And depending on how the feed line and support structure are laid out, and depending on their length, they are also doing equal amount of current, some amount of radiating. And depending on their length and layout, you can end up with a null on the horizon, and you're squirting signal above the horizon and below the horizon. That's what happens to the guys with the Ringo Ranger that hate it. Just don't happen to, they weren't smart enough to know that there's a specific set of lengths that are required for the mounting structure, and longer and shorter for that particular wavelength. It's not going to work so well until you go all the way around to the next half or the next full wavelength of extra length of mounting structure. There's a bunch of given values that will work. So without the ground plane radials, you have that ambiguity in performance. And Mel and I are guessing that that's an aggravating factor. Now, it sounds like Mr. XDJ may have experience with that antenna, maybe has something to add to it. So, Mr. XDJ, you're first going to start off with your name, and then if you're addressing this particular subject, please give us your information. If you have another question on another subject, we're going to add your name to the list, and we'll get to you reasonably soon. N2XDJ, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. My name is Dave, and you are correct. I do have some experience with the antenna. I own one, and I use it on 10 meters. And it's a 10-meter antenna that people use on CB. It's not a CB antenna. It's a 10-meter antenna. It does not require ground plane radials except to reduce some of the noise in the receive, which is also questionable. I've worked the antenna with ground planes and without them, and receive is a little bit quieter with the ground planes, but overall performance is, as far as transmitting, is the same. The antenna is designed not to need radio. It has a tunable ring. It does not require any cutting whatsoever. There's a ring at the bottom, which actually adjusts a transformer coil at the bottom of the antenna, and works great on 10 meters.
WB2HW.
Now, I've got a guess as to what could be going on here, Dave, and that is that if the antenna is nearly a half wave long, which means it's around 16 feet long, or if it's got some loading coils and it's really squeezed down, electronically 16 feet long, but a little bit shorter, then yes, that kind of an antenna, because you're launching at the end of a dipole, so to speak, as opposed to the center, very little current is required to launch that signal, and ground plane radials are no longer required. So does the manufacturer claim that it is electronically a half-wave antenna, or is the antenna really something like 8 feet long, which is really the quarter wave length of a true ground plane type antenna? So roughly, what is the length of this thing, and do they claim half wave, Dave? Back to you, Dave.
WB2HWW to comment on the 599.
Recognize. The antenna is 18 feet 9 inches long, and if you put it up on a 10 or a 15 foot mast, it's got incredible performance. Back to you.
Okay, where it's 18 feet long, for a half wavelength of 16 feet. It has all the stealth and cunning of being able to be a half-wave radiator, or ground plane radios are nowhere near as important. In fact, it is even beyond 16 feet, 18 feet. Maybe it's going into the 5/8 wave type stuff. Howie, WB2HWW, your signal was a little bit weak on those two previous transmissions, but give us your information, sir. You got it, Howie.
Is this any better now?
Quite a bit better. Go ahead with your info, Howie.
An Antron 99 is 18 feet, but you're supposed to cut the tip down to resonance. It's a half-wave NFED vertical with a shunt set. It's half-wave NFED with a transformer at the bottom to give you the impedance matching. Yes, what the radios do is give you a lower angle of radiation. They also keep the current off the feed line. You know, for general applications, not a bad antenna. I wouldn't use it on 12 meters or 15 meters, but from 28 to 30, it works fairly well. It's basically a half-wave fed with a center tap coil. Basically, it's like the transformer deck.
W2RUZ.
W2IUZ. Recognized. We'll get to you in a second. Rich, looks like we're all slowly being educated that your antenna really is a half-wave type, in which case the ground plane radials, the so-called counterpoise, is nowhere near as required as it is on a pure vertical quarter-wavelength type antenna. And so if you're still unhappy with the performance, and this is reasonably important, if you can beg, borrow, or use that you already own a standing wave ratio bridge, standing wave ratio meter, even a bird watt meter, it can measure forward and reverse power. If you can confirm that the majority of your power goes forward and very little percentage of it comes back, which means the antenna is properly tuned, the fact that it's a half-wave antenna and the fact that the standing wave ratio is reasonable, once you confirm that, then that would say electronically your antenna is doing what it's supposed to do. After that, the only thing you got left to work on is getting up to a higher altitude to clear those obstacles that are in your neighborhood. But if it doesn't pass that first test, assuming you've got reasonably low loss transmission line, so one caveat to what I just said is that if someone handed you some World War II RG-8 cable, which had been sitting on the salt water, and it's contaminated, and it's lossy as all heck, and as such, the signal gets dissipated in the cable and never gets a chance to reflect back to you. And you'll get a good standing wave ratio reading, but you can't believe it in that case. Assuming you've got reasonably low loss cable, and there's ways you can confirm that. And assuming your standing wave ratio is low, and there's ways you can measure that. Then the only thing left you got to work on is altitude, because the antenna, electronically, by all those two tests, would be telling you for the 100 watts you put into it, 99 watts is being radiated to space. And so if it's bouncing off that warehouse that's 30 feet high, you got to clear it with more tower altitude. That's a guess on my part. Let's see, W2IUX maybe has something to add to that. Mr. IUX, start off with your name, sir, and then your comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I have two questions for me that are very important on the antenna.
Yeah, stand by a minute, Howie. Mr. IUX, go right ahead.
This is W2RUZ, W2 Roger, Uncle Zebra, the handle is Les, love you, see sugar. What I have to suggest is my own experience with Stevie whip antennas. There was a time when mobile whips were stainless steel, and they were being taken off their cars and put to pasture, so to speak. People didn't become too enthralled with CB activity, so they gave up their equipment either because it was damaged or broken, or they didn't like the activity that went on. Well, I managed to capture two of these stainless steel whips, which I mounted on the end of my chimney using stainless steel strapping at an elevation of about 32 feet. Whips are mounted one above the other vertically, so it makes a vertical dipole. They're mounted on a plastic block and fed with a RG-8 cable, and the cable length is about 40 feet down into the basement ham shack, and I've been able to work out quite nicely with that combination. Thank you, Rich.
Very fine, Les. Sounds like you with those steel whips made a pretty handy half-wave dipole out of the available materials, one up and one down from the block, without spending a whole lot of money. Quite crafty. Howie, you had a couple of questions on this subject. Go right ahead.
First of all, Dick, how far is the, how far any obstacle? You know, you want to clear the obstacle at least halfway to a full wavelength long. And how old is the antenna? What happens with a lot of these antennas after a couple of years, Dick, they tend to get water in them. When water gets into the antenna and gets down into the matching network, they don't work for anything. So he has to make sure he has no water in the antenna. And one way to tell is that if you run your hand along the fiberglass and you feel like, you know, the fiberglass getting into your hands, that means the antenna's been worn down by the sun. That's one thing about that antenna. After a couple of years, 2 to 3 years, those antennas just don't work well.
Yeah, if it did suck up water, water at these frequencies starts becoming a pretty good dummy load. Water inside of your cable or inside of your type N connector or your UHF connector can create quite a bit of loss at 10 meters expand. 10 meters is not 10 gigs. You see, I'm confusing the two. So that's something else to worry about. So I guess we've given you a couple of hints here, Rich. A little bit of homework would be for you to, by one means or another, confirm that your cable is not lossy, confirm that your standing wave ratio is low, confirm that there's no water in the antenna. You've already told us you can't move those darn buildings that are around you, that are right at the edge of your property, the 30-foot high warehouse. Your property is not super big, so these buildings are darn close, not very many wavelengths away. And they're going to give you a fair amount of grief if you can't raise that antenna above them, because in the directions where those buildings are, you are going to get a significant amount of blockage. The RF will flow over the building somewhat, but at a loss. So unless you're putting in 100 watts and everyone else thinks you're running QRP, 5 watts, in that direction, and they're willing to dig into the noise and suck out your signal because you're a rare DX, other than that, life's going to be a little bit tough. And so I guess another possibility is to consider taking up mobile operation, Rich. Install some nice equipment on your automobile, and when you feel like doing some serious ham radio work, drive to the top of the hill that's somewhere within driving distance of you. There are guys who are in your situation do that, and some of them put some pretty fancy rigs on their automobile and have a lot of fun with it. KC2LTY for any other final comments. KQLIW on the TechNet.
All right, then. I mean, make a long story short, my basic question was, what is the better antenna for vertical installation other than what I have now? I mean, I have a cross-needle SWR meter. I have a tuner. I have the antenna working perfect with zero SWR. What can I put up that is better than this cheap Amtron 99? That is my major question.
All right, I'm going to answer that question in a kind of a snide way and directly. 60 feet of tower with any antenna on it would work tremendously better. Once you've confirmed that Amtron 99 is not filled with water, once you've confirmed that the antenna has a reasonable visor. Be careful now. Just because you're able with your antenna tuner to give a good visor to the exciter, the transmitter, and maybe the antenna tuner is working real hard, and your antenna has a 10-to-1 visor, that's not quite the whole answer here. What is the real antenna visor? As if you were not using an antenna tuner. If that's reasonable, and if you're sure there's no water in the antenna, then you've confirmed that antenna, you put 100 watts into it, 99 watts is going to be radiated in space. You're not going to get higher performance than that antenna is going to give you for that lens. If that antenna is giving you the right performance, I don't care if you buy something that is gold-plated, made by Mercedes-Benz, and it's called the Rock Crusher antenna, and it costs $1,000. It ain't going to work better than that antenna when that antenna is working correctly. The only way you get more gain out of any antenna on planet Earth is you must install more antenna real estate. You start making an antenna that has 3 collinear elements, each one 16 feet long, and you stack them vertically, and you properly phase them, yeah, now you're going to have a lot more gain. a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon with a lot more signal. But within the real estate of that antenna, 18 feet of length, there is no way in hell you can get more gain out of it. You can't make any antenna in that length work better if that antenna is working correctly. I know where you're coming from here, Rich. You'd like to find the magic brand, the magic type of antenna that within that length is going to give you more performance. It does not exist. Unless that antenna has some defect so that it's not radiating the 99 watts. But within that length, if he's radiating the power, there's nothing else in this world within that length that's going to give you more gain. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense, Rich. KC2LTY. K2RIW.
All right, Jack. Well, I'm not going to be putting up a tower anytime soon, but I guess I'm going to work with what I have right now. But, I mean, my 2 meter antenna is 36 feet. It's a little simple diamond X200. If I get more altitude, say 40 feet with my 10 meter, it's at 99. With or without ground planes, because there is a ground plane kit for that antenna. That was the other thing I was going to say before. They do make, I believe, is an antenna it's called the IMAX 2000. It has a ground plane kit that comes with it, one unit. I guess altitude is the key on the question. All right, I guess you answered it. Thank you very much. That's KC2LTY. Thank you.
N2XDJ.
XDJ, day recognized. So you got it. Within that length, if it's working correctly, and there's ways you can confirm if it's not working correctly, is there water in it? Does it have high standing wave ratio? And so on. If it passes those tests, you've got good feed line, it's accepting the power and not reflecting it back. That's what VISWARM really means. And it's not dissipating it in the form of heat because there's a lot of water there. Then, under those conditions, there's only three things that make an antenna work well. Altitude. Just like in the real estate business. What really sells? Location. So, I don't care if it's 10 meters, 6 meters, or 2 meters, or 432. Altitude is almost everything. I mean, a frequent question we're asked, Mel and I, is if I go from brand A, which is a $50 antenna, to brand B, which is a $750 antenna, and the two choices are, I either put the $750 antenna 10 feet off the ground, or the $30 antenna, so to speak, 100 feet off the ground, what's going to work better? I don't care if it's a coat hanger antenna. You give it enough altitude, it's going to sing. So, in your environment, it sure sounds like you need altitude. Let's see if Dave's got some further words on this. N2XDJ, K2LIW.
Yes, I didn't get a chance to say good evening to everyone on the band tonight. Altitude is very important. Having a good antenna tuner is not a bad thing to have either. I know someone who could hook up a lounge chair, a chaise lounge chair, aluminum chaise lounge chair to an antenna tuner and get out like a bandit. Having a good low SWR and as high as possible is always the best. But with respect to the Entron 99, probably one of the most perfect self-contained antennas I've ever worked. The thing can handle a couple of thousand watts, doesn't even bother it. But the ground plane kit is unnecessary, and I strongly advise not trying to install that while the antenna's up in the air.
Okay, it seems to make some sense there. If it's truly a half wave and 18 feet of length, boy, that sounds like it, then the ground plane radials are no longer very important and may give you so little change in performance, it's not worth all of the dollars and effort. That's what you seem to be saying. That's what I sort of believe. Okay, we're going to have to move on. Steve, sorry to keep you waiting so long. KC2, Mike Delta Papa, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on the net, KC2FTC. Dick, I have a question for you concerning, once again, your favorite subject, antennas. Over the weekend, I built a Yagi antenna. It is a 11-element Yagi. It's for the 33-centimeter bay at 900 meg. Down around 902, this thing works perfect. SWR is 1.5. Thing gets out like a bandit. It's in my living room. I haven't had a chance to put it up on the tower yet. The only problem I'm having is with bandwidth. Once I get up around 927, you know, simplex frequencies, SWR shoots through the roof. It's about a 3-to-1. Is there anything I can do, you know, something simple to get a wide bandwidth out of this antenna? Back to you.
Yeah, it turns out that I spend a lot of time over the last 4 years tuning antennas to give the best possible gain and standing wave ratio simultaneously from 902 to 928. That's my business, so to speak, because I'm working in the area of development of antennas for RFID's radio frequency identification tags, and they, the way the FCC rules work on that kind of a reader is that most readers will break the band into 51 individual frequencies between 902 to 928. There's something like 26 megs in there. Every half meg, you've got a channel. And the reader must randomly select hopping around on all of those frequency channels so that you're not jamming somebody's cordless telephone that's operating in the same band. That's how everybody plays nice with each other. Nobody's on any one fixed frequency. You have to be hopping on all of those frequencies. So therefore, getting an antenna with good visual across that band is the trick. There are a zillion Yagi designs. You probably already know that, Steve. And as such, some of the Yagi designs are quite a bit more narrow band than others. Common sense would lead you to believe that the more narrow band antenna would have the higher gain, and that the wider bandwidth antenna would have lower gain. Good common sense would tell you that. Ain't true. You take some of the Gunter Hawk designs, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. Dr. Gunter Hawk in Darmstadt, Germany, has spent a lifetime studying Yagi. And if you subscribe to the German magazine and get the English translated version, you'll see lots and lots of articles by him about a particular class of Yagi design, everything from around 8 elements all the way up to around 32 elements. And so his designs have near maximum percentage of bandwidth for each length of Yagi. And to cover 902 to 928 and keep the visual below around 2-to-1 with his designs is relatively easy. That's one approach to study his design. Another approach is to realize that what a Yagi does, once you've got a Yagi that is well-tuned, that means that the driven element is giving you a good impedance match, reasonably good visual. The driven element must radiate like a dipole, in a dipole-like pattern, and all of your parasitic elements must be the right electrical length, and they must all be in the right position in three-dimensional space. You fulfill those three criteria, and the Yagi's got a thing. So in your particular case, assuming the parasitic elements are the right length and in the right position, the only thing left for you to work on is all kinds of ways of fiddling with the driven element. If you go to the Tom Williams, WA1 MBA, is it? I think it's WA1 Mike Bravo Alpha. WA1 MBA is either .net or, I don't think it's .com, I think it's .net. If you go to his webpage, and I'm going to go there in a couple of minutes and confirm the website, at the bottom of his page is a series of articles by K2RIW as to how to get a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio on the driven element of any Yagi in the world. It's all outlined for you. And so in your particular case, you're happy at one end, not happy at the other end. We take the techniques that are in that article on the Tom Williams website and apply them to your particular driven element. In other words, you're going to retune your driven element while you're sitting at, let me pick a number, 926 megacycles, 925 megacycles, closer to the high end. Make it perfect there, and if you do a good job of it, it'll degrade so slowly when you go down to 902 that you'll have a good match. So before changing the Aggie design, in other words, moving around the director's length and position, that's one approach. What a lot of people do is they fall into the trap of using the first director and maybe the second director as an impedance matching device for the driven element. Yes, you can do that, but you're disturbing the Yagi forward to backward ratio, the pattern, the gain, when you do that. Since it is so simple, once you know what you're doing, to make any kind of a driven element, I don't care if it's T-match, gamma match, delta match, center fed, off-center fed, no matter how you're coupling energy into that driven element, if you follow the right procedure, there's ways you can make the standing wave ratio of the driven element as good as you want at your favorite frequency without disturbing the rest of the design of the Yagi. Since it's two separate problems, don't allow one solution to contaminate the other. As long as you know you've got a good Yagi design, it's got the right pattern and the right front-to-back ratio and the right forward gain, then do nothing but work on just the driven element. And with those procedures, you'll get that driven element down as low as you want. In the process, you may end up making the driven element shorter or longer, usually longer. And, as the article will explain to you, there are occasions when, in the process of getting a perfect impedance match to the driven element might end up longer than your reflector. You'd be amazed how many guys have lost sleep over that one. They think the whole antenna is going to explode. They think the front-to-back ratio is going to go to hell in a handbasket. No way in hell. Stop worrying about that. If that driven element has to be longer than the reflector, so be it. The reflector will do its job if it's the right length for a reflector and in the right position for a reflector, you will get the reflector action. The reflector is dumb. It doesn't know that that driven element alongside of it is a little bit longer. It's not going to make it stop acting as a reflector. You'd be amazed how many guys think that the whole Yagi procedure is going to completely fail if the reflector is not longer than the driven element. So I'm going to confirm that website for you, Steve. Maybe you already know about it. KC2, Mike Delta Papa, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Confirm it for me. While you're looking, I'll grab a pencil and write it down, and I will definitely check it out, and I will let you know next week how I made out. I'll fiddle with this thing tomorrow if I get a chance. Back to you, Dick. Dick, and thanks once again.
Okay. I just tried WA1MBA.net. That's not it. I'm now going to try .org. I should remember this by now. And is that it? No, that isn't it. Now I'm going to do a Google search on WA1MBA. Stand by. Okay, I must have spelled it wrong. It is www.whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org. You go to www.wa1mba.org. You go to the bottom of his page. It's a beautiful microwave site. And you're going to find the second item from the bottom of the page is Yagi Impedance and Matching Info. You click on that, and you'll see something called Yagi Technical Information by KQLIW. You click on that. Well, you have to go down a little bit to the bottom, where is an article called a Description of the Concepts for Yagi Matching. There's three articles at the bottom of the second page. So if you happen to be near a computer, click on that right now, and I think it's going to answer your question. It's about 2,000 words there. You read those words, you're going to be an expert on impedance matching the driven element of any Yagi or any dipole you're ever going to build for the rest of your life. And after you read that article and do it, you're going to say, why the hell hasn't somebody told me that earlier? Back to you, Steve.
Very good, Dick. I got to fire up my computer while I'm listening to the TechNet. I'll definitely look into that. I got another quick question for you, Dick. I was fooling with this thing earlier and, trying to tune this thing in. Tell me if this is true or not. Basically, what I did is I took all the elements off, all the reflectors. I took everything off, basically, the Yagi, except for the driven element and the gamma. should the SWR, basically, you know, should it act as simply as a dipole? You know, the SWR should still fall around, you know, let's say minus 1.5, the whole thing put together, you know, should be, let's say, 1.7, maybe even a little less, you know, just with the director on there. Back to you.
Okay, I know what you're asking, Steve. If you use good common sense, that the driven element should be a reasonable piece of match before you add all the parasitic elements. Good common sense. You fell into a trap dead wrong. Ain't true, Steve. Sorry. Ain't true. There are very effective Yagi designs where the driven element ends up as a 5-ohm impedance, and I'm not kidding. There are good Yagi designs that do that. And then you do whatever hell you've got to go through to make that driven element, when the parasitic elements are there, the high-performance Yagi that makes the driven element act like 5 ohms instead of 50 ohms. It's got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. And then you do whatever you got to do to match that 5-ohm antenna, and the whole thing will sing. So there's a huge interaction between the driven element and all of those parasitic elements. And each Yagi design is different. Some of the Yagi designs will make the driven element act like 35 ohms. Some of them act like 20 ohms. There are some exotic designs where the driven element is ending like 5 ohms. So you start off with a known good Yagi design, which really means the length and position of all the parasitic elements with the recommended procedure for mounting them. If the guy has you mount them on his design with a wooden boom and you substitute aluminum boom, that ain't fair. If his design has you using an aluminum boom and you're supposed to put the elements through plastic inserts in the aluminum boom so they're insulated from the boom, and you decide not to do that and you mount them, just drill holes in the boom and mount them through the aluminum and have the elements touching, that ain't fair. So electrically, you've got to obey the rules. Whatever is his recommended procedure for mounting the elements on his recommended boom diameter, follow that procedure to a T until you become more expert in Yagi tuning. Once you've got your parasitic elements, the right electrical length, because you followed his procedure, and you've got them in the right position, then you put in that driven element whatever is your favorite. I don't care if his favorite is a folded dipole and you feel like using a T-match or a gamma match. Go for it. You can make it impedance match when you follow that procedure. That's the one thing you don't have to follow in his design. You can use whatever the heck you like is your favorite driven element. But the rest of the parasitic elements, electronically you got to follow his design, or else you got a brand new antenna. There's a slim chance your new antenna is better, but there's only 50 ways you can go wrong. So parasitic elements, follow his design. Driven elements, do whatever you want, and then follow the procedure of that article, and I think you'll be home free. If you're still there, Steve, I'll send it back to you for a final. KC2MVP, and come back at the end of the net and tell me if you found that website that I told you about, K2RIW Listening.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I found this one on the internet the other night, and yeah, basically I followed it pretty exact. You know, we had everything measured out in centimeters, so I found my digital, digital caliper thing there, and I got them down within a millimeter, I'd say, all the elements, and like I said, it worked great on the low end of the band, but on the high end of the band, SWR shoots through the roof. Back to you.
And by the way, a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio is not the end of the world. I don't know the exact number, but I think it's around 3/4 of a dB of loss as opposed to a 1-to-1 VISWA. That doesn't knock you off the air. 3/4 of a dB down from where you could be. And if there's an impedance matching device nearby to the antenna, even the 3-to-1 doesn't matter. And as long as you followed his procedure for developing the parasitic elements, did you make any substitutions of diameter of elements? You got the lengths exactly right. But diameter of elements and the boom diameter and method of mounting, did you follow those portions of his recipe? Back to you, Steve.
Yes, pretty much. You know, he didn't say as far as what type screws to use. You know, he said use 632 screws. I had basically 1024 stainless around. And the only thing I did change was the diameter of the gamma tube itself. I have a bunch of 3/8 brass tube. I was using for other antenna design. So that's about the only thing I changed. Everything else is pretty much to his spec. Back to you.
Yeah, the gamma rod is the driven element, part of the driven element, and there you can use anything you want. My favorite happens to be a T-match fed with a half-wave coax balance, because it's a very symmetric technique for feeding the driven element. But that just happens to be my favorite. But where you change from 632s to 1024s or whatever, where are those screws being used, Steve?
They go through the boom. In other words, it's just a rectangular boom. He drills a 3/8 hole through the boom, sticks the element through the boom, and basically the screw just goes to the center of the boom, you know, through the center of the element, hold the whole thing together. Back to you.
Okay. Is the screw going through the boom and then through the element? Or is the screw going through the boom and applying pressure to the element so that it can't move? That's question number one. And question number two, are the elements in direct contact with the aluminum of the boom, metal-to-metal contact? Back to you, Steve.
I've done this myself, and his design is basically the same as what I was doing for 2-meter 440. I've even built 220 Aggies with pretty good success. He drills a hole through the center of the element and just takes the tap, you know, he taps his out for 632. So the screw goes through the boom and through the element, you know, and it just sort of cinches up on the whole thing. And I just used 1024. I substituted that rather than 632. And, yes, the elements are directly in contact with the boom, you know, it's a metal-to-metal mechanical, I think, I'll go into later on the element itself. Back to you.
What's the diameter of the elements, Steve?
3/8 aluminum.
I guess I'm going to guess a 3/8 aluminum tubing.